It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Soto Zen Buddhism is part of the Mahayana Buddhist tradition in which practitioners are called bodhisattvas. And the story of the first bodhisattva is in one of the Jataka tales. Those are the tales of Buddha's past lifetimes. And since the precepts that we're about to study, beginning today, are received during the bodhisattva initiation ceremony, where we become a bodhisattva, we might start by learning how a bodhisattva thinks. Therefore, I'm going to recount this delightful story of that took place countless eons ago in a city called Amaravati. So in Amaravati, there was a Brahmin named Sumedha, who experienced both his parents dying while he was still young. And a steward of the family's property displayed before Sumedha all of the gold and silver and gems that he would now be inheriting. This was seven generations of gold and silver and gems. There was a lot of it. And when he saw it, when he saw this display, he thought, after amassing all this wealth, neither my parents nor my ancestors were able to take even a single penny with them when they passed away. Can it be right that I should seek to take my wealth with me when I go? Thus, he told the king that he would give all his wealth to the poor and he would become a spiritual seeker. Sumedha thought, suppose a man, after falling into a heap of filth, hears about a distant pond covered with lotuses of five colors. That man ought to search for that pond. And if he does not, that's not the pond's fault. In the same way, there is a lake, the great deathless nirvana, in which to wash off the defilements of my harmful karma. If I do not seek it, that will be not be the lake's fault. So he left home and entered a forest in the Himalayas to practice as a hermit. Because he was a person of great capability, he attained superhuman knowledge and supernatural powers. While he was thus practicing, Dipankara Buddha appeared in the world and started to teach in a city not far from Sumedha's forest. The people immediately invited the Buddha and his followers for a meal, and to ease the way, they began to fix the road that was flooded and to decorate it with flowers. Sumedha flew there by means of his supernatural power, and seeing how hard they were working, he offered to help. Everyone knew about his powers, so they told him, if you would fix the muddy part of the road with soil, that would be good. But Sumedha, although he could easily have done this, he wanted to use his own hands instead. So he started to carry soil, but Dipankara Buddha arrived before he finished. Sumedha didn't want the Buddha to walk through the mud. So he loosened his matted hair and he lay down on the ground and he asked the Buddha to just walk on him, which was a dramatic expression of his commitment to take refuge. And even today, some Buddhists prostrate themselves all full length on the ground to pay respect and express their respect and gratitude. When Sumedha, lying in the mire, looked up at Dipankara Buddha, he made a vow. If I want, I could now enter the Buddhist Sangha and by practicing meditation, free myself from deluded human desires and become an arhat. Then at death, I would at once attain nirvana and cease to be reborn. But this would be a selfish course to pursue, for thus I should benefit myself only. I want to help all beings, as Dipankara Buddha is now doing. I am determined. I vow to attain what Dipankara Buddha has attained and benefit all beings. Dipankara Buddha, seeing Sumedha lying in the mud, understood that he had vowed to become a Buddha. He told his assembly that in a distant future, Sumedha would become a Buddha named Gautama. Hearing this prediction, Sumedha was delighted and believed his vow would be realized. Having praised Sumedha for his vow, Dipankara Buddha and his assembly left. Thus, Sumedha became the Bodhisattva, which in this case means the Buddha to be. This is an early example of the path called Bodhisattva practice chosen by Shakyamuni Buddha. So Shakyamuni Buddha chose the Bodhisattva way in the previous lifetime in which he was Sumedha. The archetypal image of the Bodhisattva in this story suggests that all Mahayana Buddhist practice is based on the Bodhisattva vow, which has two aspects, one becoming a Buddha and the other helping all beings become Buddhas. So, and this explains why Zen master Isan Ryu chose to be reborn as a water buffalo, because water buffaloes who walk in the muddy water to help farmers grow rice symbolizes Bodhisattva practice, right? They're doing Bodhisattva practice. They walk in the mud to help farmers grow rice. That's their life. It's a perfect symbol for the Bodhisattva, what the practice of a Bodhisattva is. So the verse of the called the Triple Treasure, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha, directly states the connection between taking refuge and vow, the Bodhisattva vow, where we get the precepts. So taking refuge in the Buddha, we vow together with all beings to walk this path of wisdom and compassion. Taking refuge in the Dharma, we vow to share the teachings and wisdom. And taking refuge in the Sangha, we vow to create harmony without hindrance. In the Soto Zen tradition, our practice is based on Dogen Zenji's teaching of continuous practice. And also the sameness of practice and enlightenment. So there's in Dogen's view, there's continuous, we do continuous practice and our practice is the same as enlightenment. So please listen to Dogen's truly inspiring words with your soft Zazen mind. Just let them flow through you. And last week I talked about Dogen's idea of doing, not understanding. So I'm going to ask you to do that right now. Just do, not understanding, don't worry about understanding, you actually will understand. So here is Dogen's very inspiring speech. In the great way of the Buddhas and ancestors, there is always unsurpassable continuous practice, which is the way, like a circle without interruption. Between the arousing of awakening mind, practice, awakening, and nirvana, there is not the slightest break. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. Therefore, this continuous practice is not activities that we are forced to do by ourselves or by others. It is the continuous practice that has never been defiled. The virtue of this continuous practice sustains ourselves and others. The essential point is that the entire earth and throughout heaven in the 10 directions, all beings receive the merit of our continuous practice. Although neither others nor ourselves know it, that is the way it is. Therefore, because of the Buddhas and ancestors' continuous practice, our continuous practice is actualized and our own great way is penetrated. Because of our own continuous practice, the continuous practice of all Buddhas is actualized and the great way of Buddhas is presented. Because of our own continuous practice, there is the virtue of the circle of the way. Because of this, each and every one of the Buddhas and ancestors dwells as a Buddha, goes beyond Buddha, upholds Buddha's mind, and completes Buddhahood without interruption. Because of continuous practice, there are the sun, moon, and stars. Because of continuous practice, there is the great earth and empty space. Because of continuous practice, there is the self and its environment and body and mind. Because of continuous practice, there are the four great elements and the five aggregates. Although continuous practice is not something worldly people love, nevertheless, it is the true place to return for all people. Because of the continuous practice of all Buddhas in the past, present, and future, all Buddhas in the past, present, and future are actualized. Therefore, the continuous practice of one day is nothing other than the seed of all Buddhas and is itself the continuous practice of all Buddhas. I just wanted to add that the beauty of continuous practice is that it's not something you control. Once it's on board, the practice does the practice and takes you out of it. So that's why it's so powerful. It's pure. There's no outflow, as we talked about a few weeks ago. So the practice actually does the practice once you set it up. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. These three lines from the Bodhisattva initiation ceremony are the first three Bodhisattva precepts. These are the first precepts. I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. So that's precept 1, 2, and 3. According to Dogen, the essence of the true transmission of the Buddha Dharma is taking refuge in these three, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's called the triple treasure. And when Dogen approached death, what did he do? What practice did he choose? On a long piece of white paper, he wrote three large black characters, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and he hung the paper on a pillar in his sick room, and then he roused himself to walk around the pillar. He like circumambulated, you know, he's dying. And there he is in bed, and he gets up and he circumambulates to the best of his ability this pillar where he's got sheets of paper with the character for the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. He brought his whole life energy forward to walk around these three jewels. And then he gave to them, he gave his life, and he gave his whole life to all beings. Taking refuge in when it's translated into Japanese, it has two characters, and one means to throw oneself unreservedly, like the way a parent would rescue a child who is in danger, to throw yourself unreservedly. And the second means to rely upon, the way a child leaps into a parent's arms, trusting unequivocally. Those are the two Japanese characters that mean taking refuge. And John Daido Luri Roshi relays a really sweet story from his own life that I think just absolutely conveys the spirit of this throwing yourself unequivocally trusting forward. So he says, I remember when my children were young and they were able to stand by themselves, but they couldn't yet walk. And I would stand them up on the dresser and I'd say, jump. And they would throw themselves into space, knowing I would be there. They had a complete sense of trust. It was total doing. This is John Daido Luri Roshi. Unreservedly throwing oneself into and relying upon differs, he says, from a shelter or protection from danger or distress, the more common definition of the word refuge. When you are willing to throw yourself completely into your everyday life, this is the point, when you are willing to throw yourself completely into your everyday life, moment by moment, you are taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So we bring it home. When you are willing to throw yourself completely into your everyday life, moment by moment, you are taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, in case you wondered how you do that. Suzuki Roshi said that we can't practice the way without adoring the triple treasure, and that taking refuge is an act of adoration. Adoration of awakening, adoration of the teaching of awakening, and adoration of the community of beings who practice the way of awakening, and adoration of all life, which is the way of awakening. In all traditions of Buddhism, veneration of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the triple treasure, is the basis of ethical practices and compassionate vows. In all traditions of Buddhism. But please understand, when you take refuge in Buddha, it means taking refuge in who you really are. So taking refuge in Buddha is refuge in who you really are. And when you take refuge, you're not trying to be someone else. If you are a person whose life has been organized around gaining ideas, then in the act of taking refuge, you don't try to be someone who's not the person who spent her life or his life running after gaining ideas. You work with what you are. Taking refuge in Buddha means trusting that you are Buddha. trusting that you are Buddha does not mean that you identify yourself with Buddha. It's not something special about you that makes you Buddha. It is simply that you being you is Buddha. You being you is Buddha. Even though people vary in relative levels of virtue, each of us completely is an arena for Buddha virtue to realize itself. Reb Anderson Roshi sometimes says he likes to do what he's good at, and I'm good at being me, he says. I'm good at being me. So I take refuge in being me. This is Reb Anderson Roshi speaking. So I take refuge in being me. That is my indestructible virtue, which never is lost except by me forgetting it or not facing up to it. Taking refuge means to give up running away from home. It means to recognize my responsibility to live in accord with my Buddhahood. So then he explains the meaning of the saying, I take refuge in Buddha. I myself feel like this is totally where it's at here. So Anderson Roshi explains that the meaning of saying, I take refuge in Buddha, is not in the words, but it responds to our devotion in saying these words. It's not in the words. The power is not in the words, I take refuge in the Buddha. It's in the devotion in saying these words. And that arouses a response. If our devotion is total, there will be a complete response. This is the meaning of the jewel mirror awareness. In Buddhism, we have this expression, the jewel mirror awareness. It clearly reflects our devotion like a mirror. It reflects our devotion, whether our efforts are partial or total. We get back exactly what we give. When we hold back from awakening, it may seem that awakening holds back from us. But even this reflection, we're holding back, and it seems like awakening is holding back. But even that reflection is a reflection. It's spiritual communion. And also, appeal and response come together. So past and future are cut off. We don't appeal now and get response later. It's like immediate. It's at the same time. Response, appeal and response are like identical. And I really have experienced this. It's just instantaneous. So then Anderson Roshi shares this story of Katagiri Roshi once standing in front of the altar and saying, line up the incense burner with the Buddha's nose, the center of the Buddha statue. If you place them in a straight line, then your mind will be straightforward. Lining them up straight corresponds with the arrival of your energy. Think about this. Lining up the Buddha's nose with the incense burner makes your energy straightforward. And lining them up straight corresponds with the arrival of your energy. As soon as you make this effort, your mind and heart are aligned with the Buddha. And try this. If you have an altar, you know, sometimes in cleaning the little images you have can get pushed aside or something. See what happens when you put them exactly where they belong. It's very interesting. Just notice how it feels. This straightforward mind is the mind of a bodhisattva. the straightforward mind does not expect anything in return for being straightforward. According to Anderson Roshi, who is very close to Suzuki Roshi, Suzuki Roshi once talked about a young monk whose father was a Zen priest. And when the boy was about to enter practice at a Heiji, which is Dogen's monastery, the father said, "When you get to Eheiji, you'll see that there is a big bell there. You will probably get a chance to ring it early in the morning. You will ring the bell, and after each ring, you will bow. When you ring the bell, just ring the bell. Still, when you ring it, remember that with every ringing of the bell, the great wheel of Buddha Dharma turns 1 degree. The boy went to Eheiji and he did get a chance to ring the bell. He rang it joyfully with his whole heart, just as his father had taught him. When the abbot heard the ringing of the bell, he was deeply impressed. He wondered who was ringing the bell that way and asked to meet the young monk. And the boy later became a great teacher. So just ring the bell with your whole heart. When you ring thusly, you are being met. In such a meeting, the Buddha is coming alive, the Dharma is coming alive, and the Sangha is coming alive. Do you understand? So reviewing some of the important points, first, the meaning of saying, "I take refuge in Buddha," is not the words, but it responds to our devotion in saying these words. If our devotion is total, there will be a complete response. This is the meaning of the dual mirror awareness. And second, when we hold back from awakening, it may seem that awakening holds back from us. But even this reflection of our holding back is spiritual communion. And also appeal and response come together. Past and future are cut off, and we don't appeal now and response comes later. It's instantaneous. Third, when you take refuge, you're not trying to be someone else. You're being exactly who you are. And taking refuge in the Buddha means trusting that you are Buddha. Suzuki Roshi said that we can't practice the way without adoring the triple treasure, and that taking refuge is an act of adoration. Adoration of awakening, which is the Buddha. Buddha means the awakened one. Adoration of the teaching of awakening, which is the Dharma, and adoration of the community of beings who are practicing the way of awakening, and adoration of all life, which is the Sangha. And fifth, when you are willing to throw yourself completely into your everyday life, moment by moment, you are taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And here are some things to reflect on during the week and write about in your notebooks. So first, though, the first is to just review in your mind this talk today and pick out points that for you really ring true. And they could be even small, unimportant things, but they just resonate with you. So capture those. Write them down. So when we say the continuous practice of one day is nothing other than the seed of all Buddhas and is itself the continuous practice of all Buddhas, thinking just of your own life, where does your continuous practice live? Where is your continuous practice? What do you do day in and day out that you might call continuous practice? And I would say that it would be something that you have made into a practice so that you're not in control, but the practice just does the practice. Thirdly, this idea of the essential point is that the entire earth and throughout heaven in the 10 directions, all beings receive the merit of our continuous practice. As often as you can, use this as a basis for your insight meditation sessions. That insight meditation is when you simply hold an idea in your mind gently as you meditate. You don't try to do anything, you just hold this idea in your mind. And it's one of those things that Dogen tells us, we cannot understand, yet it is so. And that the entire earth and throughout heaven in the 10 directions, all beings receive the merit of our continuous practice. That's what Dogen says. We can't understand, yet it is so. So just hold it in your mind. Don't try to understand when you meditate. That's called insight meditation. Fifth, what are the lessons that you yourself learned from the story of Sumedha, Shakyamuni's past life, in which he initially took the Bodhisattva vow? What did you personally learn from that story? That's another thing to think about or write about, or both. I wonder if there are questions.
Gil, the first question that we have is, if Buddha nature is all pervading in ordinary daily life, isn't it a contradiction to do anything to realize this? Why do we need to sit and take refuge?
I think we've talked about this before, actually. This was Dogen's agonizing question that he had all the time he was a monk in Japan, and he couldn't find an answer, and he sailed to China to get the answer. These two practices, sitting and taking refuge, they offer an opportunity to engage in our contradictory nature. And we can't get around it, and it's very frustrating, but I know I for sure have it and have uh, not sometimes not very successfully dealt with it. For I remember when I first left Zen Center, I sewed these three outfits, a kind of loose fitting top with, we called them fat pants. They were like meditation pants, in three different fabrics, one for summer, one for winter, and one for in between. And I thought, okay, now I have everything I need to wear for the rest of my life. And then, you know, immediately, like the next day, I'm out buying some blouse that I'm really attracted to and think, oh, what a great, you know, it's just like, ugh, trying to trying to not show one's contradictory nature is definitely something to contend with. Reb Anderson Roshi says, sometimes we have to do something extraordinary to realize our ordinariness. Or sometimes we need to do a special practice to need that we don't need to do anything special after all. The answer to Dogen's question, as far as I can determine, is that even though we are Buddha nature, Buddha nature needs to awaken itself to itself through our practice. Buddha nature needs rousing like a sleeping dog. There's something in Tibetan Buddhism that reminds me of this, and they kind of formalize this. It's called empowerments. So there are certain practices in Tibetan Buddhism that are extremely powerful, like the Green Tara practice, the practice of Green Tara. But you can't just bop into doing the practice of Green Tara. You have to receive an empowerment from an enlightened master, Tibetan Buddhist master. And you receive this empowerment. It's a rather, sometimes they're a rather long dragged out ceremony. And from there, you are given permission to do the practice. And if you haven't received that permission, the practice actually won't do anything for you. It won't do anything for you. So you're wasting your time, kind of. And the same goes for, there are statues. We have, you know, statues of the Buddha, statues of Avalokiteshvara or Prajnaparamita. We have these statues, but if they haven't been blessed, and sometimes I have some statues that actually have been filled with gems, they're not expensive gems, but gems anyway, that have been blessed, and then the statue actually is alive. So when I sit in front of a statue that has been empowered in this way, the energy from it is different. It's more powerful energy. So how did I get off on that? Sometimes we need to do things to empower. Buddha nature needs rousing, and we do activities to arouse our Buddha nature. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. The next question we have is, when you appeal, are you appealing for refuge or enlightenment or just anything? I don't remember hearing about appeal as something to do.
That was probably my fault. Appeal means taking refuge. You take refuge in the Buddha, in the Dharma, in the Sangha, and that's like it's a vow. It's a vow. In Buddhism, supposedly, you know, there's not a God in Buddhism. So you might read that, therefore there's not prayer in Buddhism, actually. But I pray every day, frankly. And it's kind of like mixing up vowing with this idea of prayer and appeal. It's all the same. It's all in the same boat. So not to be too precise, you don't have to be too precise in this department, because it's all about your heart. It's all about your devotion. So if there's devotion there and you're asking to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, there will be you will be given refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's like that. It's appeal and response. And again, it's immediate. It's not like you wait 3 months or check your clock or or your email. Did you get an answer yet? No, it's not like that. It's already happened. So, all right, in case that wasn't clear, taking refuge in itself is an appeal. And I'm sorry I didn't make that clear. That's all.
So somebody asked, I grew up in a family entirely organized around and adamant about gaining ideas. Attainment is my blood. Hearing that this idea merely reinforces ignorance, for example, the incorrect notion that there is an independent I at the center of my world. While I believe that, I despair, frankly, of overcoming this lifelong habit. Any advice?
It is a habit. And actually, that's good news, because habits they're alive in your nervous system. And there's a neural pathway there of your habit. And I think we've actually talked about this before. You can lay down a new neural pathway that supersedes old neural pathways. And they get the old neural pathways get less and less powerful. But you have to work for it. And the way you work for it is you, for example, in this case, you would practice thinking about lacking your own being. When I say own being, that's that independent, inherent individual existence. But that's just such a mouthful. Own being means the same thing. So practicing the acknowledgement of lacking an independent I, there's no I there. If you practice that, being really conscious and really clear, being aware of that every single day for 90 days without exception, you will lay down a new neural pathway that will supersede the idea of I'm in control and I need to, you know, beat the other guy or win the competition or whatever. The idea of there is no I lack an own being. I lack own being. To say that again and again, every single day for at least 90 days minimum. I did an experiment and I've done this. And 90 days was it was the first moment that I started noticing a difference, the subsiding of the previous habit. And so that's how to lay down a new neural pathway. And you can do that. You can do that with your gaining idea habit. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. The next question is, Soto Zen Buddhism is part of the Mahayana Buddhist tradition in which practitioners are called bodhisattvas. I didn't realize that Soto Zen Buddhists were called bodhisattvas. How is that?
I remember when I didn't realize that the way you formally become a Buddhist is by taking refuge. So there's before you took refuge and there's after you took refuge. And before, you're not formally a Buddhist, and afterwards you are formally a Buddhist. And there was one sentence in my talk about Dogen saying that the transmission into Buddhism comes from taking refuge. And you take refuge in a ceremony. This wasn't the case when Shakyamuni Buddha was alive. It was very easy. But now we have a ceremony. It's called the Bodhisattva Initiation Ceremony. And in that ceremony are the 16 great Bodhisattva precepts. You receive those precepts. It's a beautiful ceremony with repentance as the first thing. And then the second thing, well, actually, before you even get to the ceremony, you sew a robe, a Buddhist robe, either a whole robe if you're going to be a priest, or it's called a raksu, which is a miniature Buddhist robe. And you sew it in this very exact way under very strict Japanese sewing instructions, saying a prayer with each, see, there's a prayer, or maybe it's a, I'm not sure, an oath. With each stitch, you say a prayer. and it can take as long as 6 months, but it's preparing you for the Bodhisattva initiation ceremony. And on the back of the robe, the preceptor writes your new Buddhist name, which makes you a part of the lineage all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. This whole business could be the most important thing you do in your whole life. It was certainly the most important thing I ever did. I take refuge 6 times a day. So that's how it is. That's how you become a Soto Zen Buddhist, or which means you're a bodhisattva. Infant. You're a bodhisattva infant. Okay.
So another comment we have is, I see the similarity in the gesture of Sumita turning himself into a red carpet for Dipamkara Buddha, and the one of the child jumping off a chest of drawers into her daddy's arms. I begin to wonder if I've ever done anything with such wholeheartedness. It's a little depressing to consider my life from this perspective.
I know, it is sad. But going forward, knowing this, you can be extra determined that it never happen again. So to make sure that your work, for example, is absolutely compelling, that you're very involved and very behind what you do for your living. And also that your relationships are as you wish them to be. You're not just throwing them away. I see so many people miserable in their relationships and they feel trapped. And to think through really carefully what you're doing when you stay in a relationship like that. And if you use then your past wisely, and never waste a minute, it will be a gift to you. Then you can go, oh, well, if that hadn't happened, I never would have made these changes that make my life so much better and more powerful and more meaningful, and certainly of more help to other people. So use it, take it as a gift. I think recently, in one of the lectures, I was saying that everything that comes to you is a gift. If you really, really look at it, everything is a gift from the universe, every single thing. So including that you've never had the experience of wholehearted entry into an activity. Think of it as a gift. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. So this is the last question that we have. Between the arousing of awakening mind, practice, awakening, and nirvana, there is not the slightest break. Is that what Dogen means by continuous practice? From this definition, we don't even start continuous practice until we've experienced bodhicitta, the thought of awakening or enlightenment. Does not the slightest break mean that once there is bodhicitta, all the rest will automatically unfold? Or that once there is bodhicitta, all the rest are there immediately?
Immediately. That's the dual mirror awareness. It's like magic. I just want to be sure everyone understands bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the thought of enlightenment. It's the thought of, oh, all of this that we're talking about is actually something I could do. I could be a bodhisattva. Like it's a kind of amazing first idea that this all applies to you, really. That's called bodhicitta. And with that awakening mind, then you can enter a practice that is a way toward, actually, once you're in the practice, you're already in the awakening mind stream. So it's immediately, there's no delay. Bodhicitta and the continuous practice of the thought of awakening and awakening, it's all in one stream. I hope that the talk today gave you maybe a jump start in that direction. I hope so. And we'll meet again next week then. Bye-bye.